I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
This is the April 8th, 2018 Bathrob Spears Broadside Show. I'm Robert Norse. I'll be with you, but mostly my voice from the past will be with you for the next 5.5 hours. You're going to be hearing a long flashback from December 3rd, 2006. More on that in a bit. But the more current part of the show will be interviews with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, a familiar voice for many of you regular listeners, and also activist Cynthia Berger, a tenant activist, talking about the emergency rent control ordinance and the upcoming initiative. I'm going to suggest also that you look in on Brent Adams' Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz video page, the Facebook part of the video page, or the video part of the Facebook page, where he has some interesting demonstrations of what happens when you try to reach existing social service calls. I've not received any new information on the River Street campground from the city, though they're obliged to provide me with public records. They've asked for an extension. Nor have I gotten more information on the schedule. For those of you who want to talk to folks coming out of the River Street campground at where the shuttle stops, it does have a regular schedule, and I'm hoping to be able to get that to you once it's given to me. This is going to be a very difficult time for those released from the winter shelter. Already, somewhere between 50 and 75 people have been released from the River Street Shelter, Winter Shelter Program, which was both in the South County and here in the North County at the Salvation Army and also at a veterans building out on 7th Avenue. That will end, I think, formally on April 14th. And I got a call from a woman who's really concerned about what she's going to do when that happens. And I think I'll begin by playing the conversation I had with her. I'm on the line. Today is April 5th, 2018, with Dee Dee, who is an anonymous activist who has some concerns about both the winter shelter program that's ending, I guess, at the Salvation Army, and she also may have some reports on MHCan. I don't know. What's up, Dee Dee?
Well, I just wanted to say that we're having, like, lots of security checks over there, and they're breaking up they broke two zipper bags of mine, and they're going through our purses and our parcels and our food and stuff, and we don't bring nothing in. We just want to sleep.
This is the winter shelter. This is the 7th Avenue. I mean, the Laurel Street winter shelter.
Right, and I just wanted to say that I wish that they had bananas or raisins or some kind of fruit or vegetables instead of spending all the money on searching people. Mm-hmm. Because when you smoke, you have to be searched again.
Do they often... They find
like
stuff.
That's a problem.
Do they find stuff on people, Dee Dee?
No.
And how often do you get searched?
Every night.
And
our purse, our suitcase, everything we have is searched.
And
even if people searching don't want to do it because they see it's pointless.
How much stuff are you allowed to bring in to the shelter?
Oh, as much as you can carry, probably.
And
pretty much.
How close are your sleeping companions to you? Do you have cots? Do you have beds? What do you got?
We have mattresses, and some people are 2 inches away. Last night, somebody broke into my purse and broke into my lock I lock my purse, they broke into my lock, and then break my zipper. So people are in the middle of the night, people are up all night, there's a lot of addicts over there. They're tweaking or doing heroin or whatever. I don't know what they're doing, because I'm sleeping and they're doing whatever. But it's a problem, and it's the security, the amount of money spent on security when there could be a little more nutrition is just depressing, and the fact that they're cutting a day short is depressing because it's going to be cold weather for another month or so.
So when does it...
Someone out there would see that, especially the churches.
When does it close down? D.D., when does it close down?
Closes on the 14th.
I got you. And what
is Saturday?
What is your plan after that? I think you were talking about maybe applying to the River Street campground.
I'm kind of in shell shock. I don't really have a plan at the moment. I really don't know. I'm just in shell shock, and I've been sleep deprived for months. So I have to go now. Someone wants to phone.
Well, listen, thank you, and get back to us when you get your own phone, and we can do some more talking.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And one of the things Dee Dee said she wanted to do was perhaps apply for the River Street campground out on, the Boneyard Barbed Wire campground, which has a long, I don't know how long the waiting list is, but it does have a waiting list. When we spoke to Joyful Heart, one of the activist workers with the downtown safety team that both live there and work there, he said that it had about, 60 or 70 people and 50 tents. Some had two in a tent. Don't know whether there's how long that waiting list is. He said a number of people had been kind of evicted in the last or left for different reasons. This was about a week and a half ago when I talked to him. Well, maybe less. Hope to get another update from him at Monday's Red Church, where he sometimes can be found. And I'll give you more of an update, all you listeners out there, when I get it. So, I don't know if I mentioned this last show or not, but there is a way to sign up for a serving dinner at the River Street Campground if you are, for example, housed or homeless and interested in being a part of that. I don't know how many homeless people they take in as servers, but you can do that by going to signupgenius.com online, and that would be for a serving dinner at the River Street Campground. Usually it's down the road a couple of weeks, if not a month or two. Campground's slated to run, I think, till June 30th, at which point they're talking about some other alternatives which have not been clarified. It may be the hard bricks of the sidewalk or the rustle of the bushes or the rush of the underpass of the freeways, or just to get out of town, or we'll arrest and harass you wherever you are and take your stuff, which is the more traditional Santa Cruz peril that homeless people face. You can also help Food Not Bombs serve food, and that's a lot easier. You just go to the Saturday and Sunday meal. There's a Sunday meal at 4 to 6 at the across from the town clock at the post office or near the main post office in downtown Santa Cruz. They need your help, and I guess you can show up at noon on Sunday and noon on Saturday at India Joe's restaurant where they prepare food for the 4 to 6 meal on Saturday and Sunday at the post office. You can also go online to the Facebook Food Not Bombs page and get more information there. One of the reasons I suggest looking at Brent Adams' Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz Facebook page video is he tries to really go out there frequently and regularly, it seems, and he wants to explore both the positive aspects and the limitations of current Santa Cruz services and Santa Cruz police treatment of the homeless and the homeless situation outside here in Santa Cruz. And while Brent, I, and others have many differences in strategy and tactics and orientation and tone and so forth, he does provide you with some kind, definite documentation of some stuff that's happening out there. Again, Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz on the Facebook page. Not much to report on the upcoming shitty council meeting on Tuesday that I see by a quick look over their agenda. That's going to be on April 10th. But April 9th on Monday is the day before City Council is Tom Lehrer Day. It's been proclaimed honoring the songs, Life and Songs of Tom Lehrer, who is, I don't know if he's retired. He must be retired. He's in his 80s. Was a mathematics professor and, of course, a fine singer of satire in the 50s and 60s, and I think then fit into the 70s, too. The City Council has a different schedule this week. They seem to be shifting it around as ever. They have an afternoon session that starts at 3:30, which is kind of late, according to their agenda anyway, and at 7 o'clock, as well as their usual 5:30 doghouse oral communications time when you can actually yap for 2 minutes until Mayor Terrazas abruptly and officiously cuts you off, although with a very mellow and sweet attitude, of course. There's also the Sean Arlt murder, or killing, depending on how you want to view it, coming up. There's a claim against the city, which is not being clarified on the website. They aren't posting the the actual specifics that the family of Sean Arlt, or the attorney for the family of Sean Arlt, is putting forth there. He was, of course, shot dead by Santa Cruz police in the fall of 2016. The reports by the police officers, all the audio and video, have never been revealed, and in spite of repeated demands by members of the community, myself included. So the closed litigation session of the City Council starts at 2:30, very late for a closed litigation session. That's a session which includes an open interval with the normal City Council chambers for a very short period of time, but you're then allowed to speak on the case. And the case that interested me is a conference with legal counsel, existing litigation for Arlt versus City of Santa Cruz in U.S. District Court. And, of course, I probably should be researching that case if I ever wanted to get down to the U.S. District Court to do it, or go online to find it. Maybe I will at some point. It's not actually a final claim on the decision on the claim of Sean Arlt, a financial claim against the city. I suspect that claim may have already been made and it's already gone to court, and this is an attempt to settle it, but I have no further information on that. Not a lot on the council agenda looks terribly interesting to me, though there's a very long consent agenda, which means an agenda you're not allowed to speak on except for a total of 2 minutes for what appears to be, or actually is, 18 items. So, you know, that's, 15 seconds per item or something if you want to talk on all of them, or a very small number if you want to talk, amount of time, even if you want to talk on just a few. Sandy Brown, to her credit, the one thing she has done, although she has not carried through other promises made, is that she has agreed to remove items from the agenda and done so when individuals ask that they be removed, which means that they could then be talked about individually and voted on independently and also get a staff report on them and so forth. That's for all you council hounds. If you want to talk more to Sandy Brown, you can call her directly, 246-0399. I haven't been able to reach her since she essentially made promises last week that I should have known better, that she still hasn't kept. But that's her number, and she has meetings that you can also arrange to chat with her, as other council members may indeed as well. So let's listen now to an interview with Cynthia Berger on the rent control ordinance that passed in emergency session, or I should say as an emergency measure in regular session, back in February. Cynthia is also part of a campaign to pass as a formal initiative a rent control board and to set in firmer basis the rights of tenants in Santa Cruz, at least some tenants in Santa Cruz.
Okay, well, it is April 3rd, 2018. It's around 2:15 to, well, it's closing on 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm chatting with tenant activist Cynthia Berger. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Robert.
Greetings. And you're with the, give me the proper name of this group again.
Okay, well, I am with Santa Cruz Tenants Association, and Santa Cruz Tenants Association is a member organization of the coalition called the Movement for Housing Justice that's working on the Santa Cruz rent control campaign.
And how many other organizations are part of that group, and if you know, what are they?
Well, the NAACP, the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, and I don't know any. I don't know. There's not a lot of organizations. There's a lot of individuals.
Mm-hmm. So, this campaign.
Oh yeah. Another one is Students United with Renters.
Good. This campaign's been going on, well, formally, for what, about 2 months, month and a half?
Well, formally, it's been going on since last fall.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, so that's when we started getting coalition members interested in pledging funds.
You've been working
on some money.
You've been working on this issue yourself for much longer than that, right?
Well, I mean, which issue? Rent control or just tenants' rights?
Both.
Well, I've been studying rent control since it passed in Richmond and Mountain View in November 2016. So, yeah, I have spent a lot of time talking to the folks to ask how the campaign unfolded and, you know, just a lot of details about what kinds of things come up during a rent control campaign, that what kinds of fires might need to be put out, and what do we need to look ahead to, what do we need to, what's the word, anticipate.
And previously, you were concerned with tenants' rights.
Well, my organization is called Santa Cruz Tenants Association, and what I do in that is I have a website and a hotline. So I get calls usually every day from, and I've been doing that for about 4 years. I've had really the only tenant hotline for a long time. Now there's another one popping up, which is great, but mine is the only one that is actually bilingual. Although I think they're getting some Spanish speakers for the other hotline as well. But mine is 831-222-0359. And it's also on my website. And then I'm also available by email, santacruztenants@gmail.com. And what I do is people call, they have questions. I'm pretty up on tenants' rights, and I'm not a lawyer, so I always explain that. But I do know what kinds of situations might require a lawyer and which ones lawyers aren't going to be interested in, which is most tenants' staff. And, yeah, so I help people to know their rights. And then as part of that, I will go to people's houses. Sometimes I will write letters for their landlords. I will help them write a letter. And I will, if they need someone to stand in for them, if a landlord is doing an inspection, then I can be there, or I can just be there as a witness. We actually find that just being present helps tenants to, well, for one thing, having someone from a tenant organization present seems to have a good effect on the behavior of landlords. Some landlords, not all, can be a little disrespectful or intimidating to tenants and some property managers. And so we'll go, and it's mostly me really right now, but I'm always willing to train other people to join up.
Now, that was what I was going to ask you, Cynthia. Pretty much, it's been a lone wolf operation for you for a number of years, no? Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, it has, but it's not really by choice. It's just that it's not really that easy to find people who are, you know, want to do this kind of work. You know, it's a particular kind of work, so.
And you don't operate with a government grant or a large foundation grant or even much of a grant at all. You do this.
I just do it as a volunteer, and I have a day job.
And how many hours a week would you say you spend doing this?
I don't know. I never really counted, but a lot. I mean, I'd say 30, 40, maybe.
Is it satisfying work, or how do you feel at the end of a week usually, or is there any usual feeling?
Well, you know, that's so interesting. I was thinking about it today because now that there are two temporary emergency rent control ordinances in the city of Santa Cruz, there's so much more positive stuff to say to tenants, and it makes work more enjoyable to be able to tell people, hey, you actually have some legal protections now that mean something. So before it was, I felt like almost like a counseling service because people, tenants, renters are so traumatized because people in this county are paying such a huge percentage of their income towards rent. And they call and they just, they need to talk. Sometimes they need to talk for a good half hour before they really, you know, can discuss their options. And so, you know, I'm kind of like in the Peanuts cartoon when Lucy sits at the table with the sign that says psychiatrist, 5 cents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's very traumatizing to deal with housing in a lot of areas of California, and especially here.
Now,
jobs pay less.
Has the number of contacts you've been, the number of incoming calls or emails increased in the last few weeks because of the passage of the emergency ordinances by the city council?
Well, you know, they have increased a little bit, and some of them have been about that those particular ordinances, but it's fairly steady. I'm not getting a whole lot more. We've been canvassing to get signatures to put rent control on the ballot next November, so we have been out, the coalition has been out talking to people. So I think at least the tenants are knowing more about it. They're aware of it. Now, the city council has just put a Spanish frequently asked question on their website. So if anybody's listening to this show, please tell your Spanish-speaking neighbors that they can go to the City of Santa Cruz website, and there's a frequently asked question document that's been translated into Spanish. We did ask them to do that. And so I've been actually speaking with some Spanish-speaking renters recently, and sometimes the landlords of Spanish speakers believe that they don't know the laws and are too intimidated to speak up. So I'm trying to, just work with a group of people in a complex that got a illegal rent raise after the ordinance passed.
Now, there's a higher proportion of Spanish speakers in Watsonville, I understand. Has the passage of this ordinance in Santa Cruz encouraged similar efforts down there?
Well, there are a couple of people who have come up here to canvas, and they live in Watsonville, and they're interested in bringing rent control to Watsonville, because not only Watsonville, but the county. For example, the Live Oak area, there are thousands of tenants in that area who could benefit from rent control, and really also in the San Lorenzo Valley. So, but there's a concentration in Live Oak. So, you know, we are trying to bring in other people, find tenant advocates or tenant activists in other parts of the county. I mean, even the city government in Watsonville, some members of the city government were glad to hear that Santa Cruz was getting rent control, because so many people are fleeing Santa Cruz for Watsonville and putting a lot of pressure on their housing market, so it's not going to be as affordable as it was, and it's just going to be more gouging and less ability to find housing because there just isn't enough housing.
Any whispers of a Watsonville City Council move to replicate what's going on in Santa Cruz or go beyond it?
Well, what they did do is they did a study. I heard that from Rebecca Garcia on Facebook last summer, and then I heard it again recently. And so the city did just a brief, basically, I think what they didn't really do a study. What they did was they probably looked at their statistics that they keep for their housing element, which is a required document. It's required by the state of California. And it breaks down all the different kinds of housing. And so by looking and analyzing the different kinds of housing, you can see how many units would be covered by rent control. But that doesn't tell you how many people it's going to help, because you have no idea how many people are in every unit, especially around here. So, you know, they want to say, oh, well, it doesn't help very many, you know, very many renters. But the fact of the matter is there's nothing else that can help renters in Watsonville or Santa Cruz.
Now,
the only possible thing that can help renters overnight is to pass rent control.
Now, the My recollection of the history of tenant activism, particularly in the 90s, involved the Santa Cruz Tenants Union with Donna Dice and her partner, whose name I can never remember.
Interesting. I don't know much about that.
Yeah. I think at one point I suggested you might want to get in touch with her because she was active in a way similar to you, although she would go down. I think I mentioned to you this in a previous interview. She'd go down to the courts and see where unlawful detainers were happening and inform the victims, who apparently sometimes didn't know that was going on, and try to advise them until they shut the records for some reason. That's what she later reported to me. And
well, you see, they shut the records for a good reason, and that's because landlords send someone like Donna Dice down there who doesn't have good intentions, and that's how blacklists are built. So they did close records, and they try to make it a little harder, but landlords have a lot of money. The landlord lobby, I should say, has a lot of money, and they pay people to do that, and then they pay landlords to get access to lists of people who have had unlawful detainers. So, yes, they close the records. It does make it harder for us to find landlords, though.
Yeah, you know, I think Dice being firmly on the side of the tenants, you know, I doubt she would agree with you. Maybe she would. I'm not sure. But in any case, I'm good to get in touch with her, I would suggest, and I'm going to suggest she get in touch with you. I think she's on Facebook, and it's spelled D-I-S-S.
Yes, I'm aware of her. I probably even had a conversation with her. But blacklisting is a real thing, and the state of California actually made a law against it in 2016 because it affects many thousands of renters. So if you want to pretend like it doesn't happen, okay, but just because you're not doing it doesn't mean somebody isn't paying them.
I'm not really.
$10,000.
Yeah, I don't want to argue, but I don't have the fact.
That's a real thing, so I don't know what she would
say. I don't have the facts to argue about it, but all I know is that she and, what was his name, Ricardo, something like that, were really active, and this action happened at a local level, not at a state level. It happened in 1999 or 1998 or thereabouts. So, but in any case...
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, but...
You know about that.
Yeah, I mean, don't take it from me. She would know better. And also, you know, she might give you some indication. There was tepid by Scott Kennedy, was on the city council at that time, promising to do a just eviction protection law, which he never did, as far as I know. And that's actually, of course, why I called you, which is to come to some understanding of the differences between the emergency ordinances that were passed in February by the city council, surprisingly, although perhaps not so
surprisingly. Yes, very surprisingly, and I'm grateful that they did, because they saved a lot of tenants their housing by doing that.
Yeah, but perhaps not so surprisingly, because they don't seem to be interested in enforcing any of this stuff. And I'm hearing that there are, I'm not sure if I heard it from you or from others, I think from Zav, perhaps, another tenant activist, that there are cases of people who are refusing to follow the rent freeze requirements or the just eviction requirements, and instead... the city is doing nothing about it. I guess that the...
Some of these issues are... They're not something the city could do something about, and some of them are. Eviction issues are court issues. So eviction is governed by the Superior Court of California. So it's we can change the law, but as far as enforcement, it has to go to the court. It's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. They're all civil matters.
Yeah, but
I'm not sure, you know, what
the actual city pass an ordinance which essentially says don't raise the rents beyond 2% for the 22% of households covered by the ordinance.
Yeah.
And if landlords are doing that, it may be the ordinance is so toothless, the city has no responsibility or obligation to deal with it. My understanding was the city's too cheap or too disinclined or claiming it's going to be a huge expense for them.
Here's what I think about it.
Tell me about that.
Tenants cannot depend on other people. Nobody cares about tenants except tenants. And they're the ones who are going to have to enforce these rules. So as tenant activists, we don't want to fail, and we need to get more people helping us to get the word out to tenants. Because tenants they don't have to pay the rent increase. They need to understand that they don't have to pay it. That's the main thing. We need to have more public meetings or private meetings or people talking with tenants and public education about it. Now, that's something that we would like the city to do, education, because that helps with enforcement. But the tenants themselves can write a letter, or they can have Santa Cruz Tenants Association or Students United for Rent with Renters write a letter to the landlord. Sometimes the landlord, you know, in some cases, probably not most, they might not know about it. They might live somewhere else, but most of them should know about it. And so some of them pretend they don't know about it and raise people's rents. And then some of those people call me. And so what I do is I meet with them and I explain, hey, here's a letter I wrote. It's in English and Spanish. And I can send this to your landlord. And it's just informing them about the law.
Now, what
anyone who doesn't have documents in it, and so they have no idea.
That brings me to the key question. What exactly is the law in terms of the consequences for a landlord if she or he does illegally try to collect rent improperly?
These laws are not about consequences for landlords. These laws are about benefits for tenants. You know, let's be realistic about it. These are civil things. And the fact of the matter is, if everybody kind of knows that if you're a tenant and your place gets red tagged, maybe you complained about it and it gets red tagged, you get thrown out with not a red cent, and the city doesn't do jack about it, even though, well, they have an ordinance about relocation. I just got a call from a person who had this happen twice in the past 6 months. He got red tagged, he had to move out, the landlord has never paid any of the tenants a red cent, and the city knows it. And then he moved to Live Oak, the same thing happened there. He's not going to get a red cent. And he's owed $8,000, $9,000 now from this kind of, these illegal, people who are called on their illegal rental situations, these landlords, they don't pay relocation.
Now, is that the case?
I think it should be a crime, not a civil matter.
Is that the case in other cities where there are just eviction protection ordinances? Is there similarly a lack of enforcement, or is this currently just only the situation in Santa Cruz?
I believe there is, but here's the situation. There is more enforcement in a city that has passed permanent rent control because they have a funded rent control board whose, duty is to monitor the law just the integrity of the law and that it's being honored. But even in those places, it's always a struggle because people who own property have many more rights than people who don't.
Now, are you speaking after having contacted those places or just sort of more in more generalities?
Well, I'm not really good at giving, I know the specifics, but I'm just not really good at a person at calling up details on telephone calls and interviews, so I usually send other people who are good at that. But yes, I have spoken with the head of the Berkeley Rent Board, the executive director, actually. There's a board and there's an executive director, and he's been the executive director for at least 10 years. And I've spoken with their lawyer, and I've just had different conversations with people. Like, I went to City Hall in Richmond, and they're just starting a new program and stuff. So, I found out a lot about it. But, there's only so much that you can do. But I can tell you, it's better to have rent control than no rent control.
Now, there's some cities that don't have rent control but have just eviction protection ordinances, like San Jose.
Yeah, those are really no good because without rent control, who cares? You're just getting evicted by rent raise.
I understand that, but I'm asking you, in those cities, have you had any contact with them? I'm not saying, you got your hands full, and you should have.
Oh, yeah, no, I do. I actually go out of this city a lot to find out what's going on.
So in the cities like San Jose that don't have rent control but do have the so-called just eviction protection, is there any more protection than there was, let's say, in Santa Cruz previous to February of this year?
Yes, there is, because there's somewhere at least, because there's a law, when the tenant goes to court, now the landlord has a burden of proof. That is the new protection. Before, they could just kick you out and they didn't have to have any reason whatsoever. And in fact, there was a Sentinel story about a tenant about a couple of months ago, a woman, and she was being evicted for no reason. She lived there for a long time. But the fact of the matter was, she wasn't evicted because the eviction took effect after February 13th. So they were no longer able to evict her without a reason.
Well, remember, Cynthia, what I'm asking about is not after our ordinance went into effect, but before our ordinance went into effect. How does that compare with, say, San Jose's situation or a city that has no rent control
but
does...
The one thing is that they're now when they go to court, if somebody evicts you for a cause that's not in the law, you don't have to leave.
You're missing my point, Cynthia.
And they have the burden of proof.
Yeah, Cynthia, you're missing my point. I'm not asking what the situation is now. I'm asking what the situation is for, say, a city that has no rent control but just eviction protection.
I'm talking about San Jose.
Right. Okay, and so in other words, the just eviction law in San Jose actually provided that change for the landlord burden of proof? Is that what you're saying?
That's what just cause eviction is all about.
Thank you. I appreciate your clarifying that.
Basically, it's all about now there has to be a reason, and who proves the reason? Not the tenant. The landlord. If they're going to say they're kicking you out, they gotta have only a particular reason, and they got to be able to prove it.
So now let's talk about how things have improved in Santa Cruz under the current ordinance, but how that would improve further or change further with the passage, first getting on the ballot in September and then passing in November, of the ordinances that are being circulated in Santa Cruz, the rent control ordinance and the just eviction protection ordinance. But to follow that conversation, you're going to have to check us out on Thursday evening when the show, a smaller version of the show, comes out between 6 and 8. Now I'm going to turn to Keith McHenry and some chit-chat on the boulevard. And we'll get back to Cynthia on Thursday evening.
Talking with.
Oh, my God. Okay. Keith McHenry went to Penny University.
We're hanging out on Pacific Avenue, which has become completely gentrified and sterilized. It's about 8:45, 8:50 on April 3rd. I ran into Keith here in front of New Leaf Market, where I'm actually leaning against the building.
I suspect this is illegal, right?
No, Fitzmaurice tried to make it illegal, but he was unsuccessful.
Good, thank God.
That was many years ago. But I do notice there are zero musicians on the street and few people who you would call even stationary social groups, whether homeless or not.
Although this one woman has stayed in that doorway of the abandoned building now for like a week and has not visibly moved. Yeah, she's there.
I don't see her now.
Well, let's watch that way while we're doing the interview. I've been amazed at her resilience that no one is. Yeah, she's still there.
Oh, really?
So, it's been fascinating that has happened. And,
And here we are. It's true. At 11:32, there's a woman covered up with a sleeping bag and a space heater blanket or whatever that is.
Yeah, and that person has been there nonstop for days, which is... And I've stood there and watched strangers walk by and do nothing, which is fascinating. I don't know why they're intimidated by her. What the story is.
Maybe she's become a part of the landscape.
Yeah, she might have. Although it is interesting to see how intense people stare at her. Oh, yeah, it's about time. So, it is interesting how many people kind of stare at her when they're walking by. I'm going to sit on this illegal bench here.
Is it an illegal bench?
Well, I'm sure it is, yeah. Why would everything be...
front of the Del Mar Theater, actually.
Yeah, the Del Mar Theater. And there's had... But the people that go in those two places get kicked out.
You're pointing to the two empty buildings between the Pizza My Heart and the Del Mar Theater.
Yeah, and so...
And you'll begin to hear music. There is a musician that we came into the range of who's across the street playing on a very kind of... I don't know the name of this instrument. It's like kind of a haunting choral melody. Also, of course, I'm talking with Keith McHenry, who's the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, and a continuing activist when Many others have fallen away, and he also serves and has helped to organize food twice a week at the town, across from the town clock, at the post office.
But they tend to be younger people with signs, and so here it is, like not even a block, and one person has been permanently there.
Ensconced, and the others are driven away. These are also, you might have, these are vacant businesses. Both of them have been vacant for some time, 1122.
Although they got permits on them, so there's supposed to be something coming in there, building permits. And then, of course, the bottom of Logos is still empty, and then down the other end, there's a ton down by Mission on... are empty. There's like five in the first block that are empty on Pacific Avenue. So,
well, you know, it's interesting to me because the temperature is, although it was cold this morning, it has gotten warmer at the moment. The wind is not blowing, and there's, well, I do hear music from across the street, so I think there's one musician at least who remains on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah, well, there was, I think his name is Mark that hits the drum in the same beat endlessly forever.
Tamarack.
Yeah, he...
I saw him sitting at the coffee roasting company near James the Jeweler, who has been sort of driven, tickets drove him away from the area where he was showing jewelry.
Yeah, he now has to show jewelry in the coffee roasters or in other establishments. But I have heard that from a number of people are pretty angry at the Abbott Square, so that's kind of the new thing.
What's Abbott Square, of course, is an area that's been gentrified. Oh, kind of a wall or a fence has been created around it, and it's kind of become a middle-class playground of a certain sort. How would you describe Abbott Square?
Well, Abbott Square is where it's next to where the old jail was and where the octagonal building where they had the...
the Octagon, as they call it.
Yeah, the Octagon, and it had all the city records years ago and all that, and is now full of puppets for some reason. And
what about the coffee shop that was there? What was it called? Something on the square.
That was Lulu's, and it's...
Lulu Carpenter's.
Yeah, Lulu Carpenter's is now, but if it... Now there is a coffee shop inside, which is, I don't think, in any way related to Lulu's. But... anyway, so several people have told me that. So when I was like in between places, I'd spend a lot of my time at Abbott Square using their internet and just sitting there and drinking water, and never bothered by anybody.
Now this was outside in Abbott Square,
or inside in the little atrium area where the, you know, in the little area where there's a bunch of little restaurant shops and stuff. I usually sat, because I had to stand up because of my back injury, I stood at the tall tables inside, and it was in the winter, and it was cold.
So this was last winter or winter?
January. I spent a lot of January in the afternoons there writing, and I never had a hassle. But apparently in the last couple of weeks, several people have... In one case, one person went to the vegan place and got lunch, and then he got to talking to somebody, and then he had to go to the bathroom, and then he went to a person and said, "Hey, what's the code to the bathroom?" And they said, "You have to go to where you bought your meal to get the code. We're not allowed to give you the code unless you bought something with us."
Was this a
week or two ago? Yeah.
With the status in January when you were there?
It was not the case in January. This is just all, I heard this in the last, I heard it all yesterday, but it happened in the last couple of weeks. So the person went back to where he bought his food, and the person that sold him the food, it was no longer there, and it was a new person, and the new person wouldn't give him the code because he hadn't recognized him from, and this is a person that's, you know, of relative means, and to be treated that way was kind of crazy. It seemed to me when I go there, particularly in the evenings, on weekends, it's like not really exactly. If you call people making a few $100,000 a year middle class, I guess that's true. But it's the people with some money, it seems like, you know, that populate the whole thing. It seems like what we used to call yuppies back in the 80s. And, Anyway, so then I've heard, and then two other people told me the same story. They were told that they couldn't just sit there.
Do we know who the management of this place is?
And the manager is a person by the name, I think of Kit, if I'm not mistaken. But
not Chip.
No, not Chip. And when the place was announced that it was going to happen and everything, the Sentinel and the Good Times had articles, which I think we could all go back and read the quotes of people saying how this was just a new plaza for everybody in town, and everybody's welcome, and so on and so forth. And as predicted, it's not really that, unfortunately.
It was for the better citizens, Keith.
Yeah, so that's one little story I heard, and then...
Not only refugees or roustabouts or vagabonds. I mean, their kind can go to the Food Not Bombs meals and hide in the bushes. That's perhaps Chief Mills has a place for them.
Yeah.
What did you hear about our police chief, anyway? Anything?
Well, I haven't heard much about him, but I did hear I found this interesting. Brent Adams, one of my favorite people in town, had some really good points about...
Now, you and Brent, didn't you always see eye to eye?
Yeah. Well, there's a few things that are critiques that it's fascinating. Because when I first, before Brent threw the stale croissant in my face and tipped over the table and everything, for me doing an emergency breakfast outside the homeless lack of services center when the plan to alter it dramatically so no one could get food or stay there.
June of 2015.
Yeah, that was June of 2015. He was doing Sanctuary City. Sanctuary City, he was very excited about that. And I had actually been to some of the sanctuary cities that he...
I believe they call it a sanctuary village.
Villages and stuff, yeah, whatever they're, you know, I've been to the ones in Seattle, I've been to the ones in Portland, I've been to the, you know, I knew people that were kicked out of the one in San Jose.
Is there a sanctuary village in San Jose?
This is the thing, is the community that was set up in San Jose in the 90s, which I think was called, I forget what it's called, but it was like a... It became like essentially a concentration camp, and
set up by the government or by
set up by the city. Yeah, I think it was the city, maybe the county.
I hadn't heard about that. Interesting.
It didn't last very long because there was kind of generally a revolt, and so a lot of people migrating from that to San Francisco are the ones that related stories to me about it, and
You were in San Francisco till about 1996.
97 is when I left. Yeah. So the in this and that kind of stuff was early 90s. Maybe 93, 94.
But jumping back to Brent.
So I had suggested early on, in a non-confrontational way, that one would want to be careful about such a thing, because if the city is not very progressive, they tend to turn them into kind of concentration camp type things, minimum security jails. And so I found it interesting that his description of the Boneyard campsite was...
River Street Campground, please.
Was exactly as I had warned him about. Because at that, you know, he was like thinking he was going to have this alliance with the city council, and the city was going to somehow embrace and work with him to set up a camp that everybody could stay in.
And I believe he still has that hope.
Yeah. But in this particular case, the camp that got set up is not so friendly. His critique was this, that a high percentage of the people there are in this clean sweep program.
Oh, the downtown safety team.
Yeah,
And little orange jackets.
Correct. So that they seem to have gotten priority for the campsites, and then that it's costing $90,000 a month, and he said he could do it for a whole year for $100,000, and something of that nature. He says, I'm sure you could do something like that for $100,000, and and that it was like having a police station near it and guards outside and restrictions getting in and out and all this was inappropriate.
No visitors.
Yeah, so he was not excited about this camp, which I found interesting since it kind of is what he was. It was what, you know, I warned him that that's what can happen if you get a government too involved in a homeless camp like that.
And that's about it for Keith at the moment. But we will again come back to him on Thursday, hopefully, and as I continue this interview. So now, as a remembrance and tribute to Tom Lehrer, who hasn't done much in the last 35 years around political satire, but I was brought up on him and loved him. Here's one of his songs that still, well, it hits the mark.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. Down by the old mail. Strong. There'll be a storm before the calm, and we will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake with complete participation in that grand incineration. Nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. Oh, we will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. You will all go directly to your respective Valhallas. Go directly, do not pass, go, do not collect $200. And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes uranious, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
Finally, here's a shout out to Abby Samuels, who has put up a video, Loudon Nelson Center Discriminates Against the Houseless in the City of Santa Cruz, on the Food Not Bomb Santa Cruz video page, YouTube. Check it out. It's really interesting. She points out the fence that's gone up around Laurel Park. We can't use the bathrooms anymore. It's a pretty nasty and sad situation, and she's seething with indignation, as she should be. Check it out. And again, that's on the Facebook page of Food Not Bombs. So for the rest of the show, and this is the majority of the show, I'm going to play most of the December 3rd, 2006 Bathrobe Spears broadside show from 12 years ago, nearly. It includes part of the prior show, The Wake-Up Call, with activist Troublesome Thomas Levitt, in which I, as his guest, play some flashbacks within this flashback from 1992, when San Franciscans were demonstrating in mass against the martial law declared by then-mayor in the wake of protests and demonstrations around the verdict freeing the beaters of Rodney King. They didn't kill him, they beat him down in Los Angeles. This includes interviews with David Nadell over in People's Park, Berkeley, who was himself shot dead 3 years later. It includes bits from the 1992 Santa Cruz City Council meeting on the homeless services or lack of services situation and the police review board. At that time, there was no police review board, but Butchie Baker, the then a sergeant, I believe, was an officer. Well, he was one of those two. He had been accused by 9 or 10 women of improperly searching them, feeling them up, in essence. And it was a scandal that was quickly hushed up by then-city manager Dick Wilson. My co-host on this 2006 show was Tenderfoot Tim Rumford, who talks about other events that were contemporary back then in 2006, as we also kept jumping back to 1992 on the discrimination by Manthri Srinath, the Lulu Carpenter's owner at that time, who took a disliking to Shane Maxwell, who was panhandling with his little bunny in front of Lulu Carpenter's, or just down the road, and got essentially verbally attacked and harassed by Manthri Srinath. We talk about him. There's voices from the past, which includes still present activist Lighthouse Linda LeMaster, attorney Margaret Marr, Tim Fitzmaurice, former council member Scott Graham, scope it out Scott as I call him, Residentes Unidos leader Nena Ruiz, who subsequently died of a heroin overdose. Lots of stuff in this December 3rd, 2006 flashback that flashes back further, even as it flashes before you today. So check it out, enjoy it, and hopefully on Thursday I'll have some more new stuff for you, or at least a conclusion to Cynthia Berger and Keith's interviews. And if you have something you want to bring to my attention, please give me a call on the Huff line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's Huff, the group I work with, at 831-423-4833, 423-4833. We won't be meeting next week at the Sub Rosa Cafe, where we usually do on Wednesday at 11, but we will be meeting a week down the road. So you can become a part of Huff by coming to those meetings, by calling me up, and I'll put you on my email list, or by listening to this show and contacting me with news briefs. You can also get $500 if you find us a studio space anywhere in Santa Cruz, within a few miles of Santa Cruz, that has a 10x10 space for, also has available audio, I should say electricity, internet access, and a place to take a dump. So that's it. But the flashback is about to begin, so don't go away.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. uranium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.